ARUP acknowledges the traditional owners across all lands, waters and skies the firm may reach. We acknowledge their wisdom, resilience and rich cultural heritage. We pay our respects to the elders past and present, and to all Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander peoples. We recognise the ongoing journey of healing and reconciliation, and ARUP commits to walking alongside First Nations peoples to acknowledge their teachings and foster a future of unity and respect.
Welcome to Sustainable Forces, ARUP's podcast about people partnering for the planet. I'm your host, Dr. Michelle Dickinson, and I'm coming to you from the iconic Sydney Opera House, where I have just hosted Momentous, an annual event bringing together great minds to explore bold ideas and brave actions for a sustainable future. Now, I know you're thinking, didn't we just wrap up season 3 of Sustainable Forces? Yes, we did, but we could not resist bringing you this special edition episode, recorded live at Momentous, to share a thought-provoking conversation about how we can build real momentum in tackling the challenges of climate change. And joining me for this discussion were Zoe Whitten, Managing Director of Pollination Group, Hilda Tunney, Chair of the ARUP Group Board. And together, they offered powerful insights into how the APAC region, one of the most climate-vulnerable yet opportunity-rich parts of the world, can step into a position of true leadership on the journey to net zero. I hope you enjoy this special episode. And remember, you can now watch this conversation along with season 3 on YouTube.
Good evening and a warm welcome to you all. I know it's very exciting seeing other humans, and don't worry, there's going to be plenty of time for chatter and wine and networking later. But a warm welcome to you all. It is my pleasure to be your host for this evening's event. My name is Dr. Michelle Dickinson, and I'm very excited to welcome you to Momentous 2025, the third annual celebration of thought, leadership, innovation, and bold action, proudly presented by ARUP with the kind support of the Sydney Opera House. So for those of you, there's about 600 of you joining us from the live stream. Hello, welcome. Sorry, we don't have wine transferred to you, but there's plenty of wine here in the room for those of us who are here. And for those of us who are here drinking the wine, you might want to know, via the housekeeping, that the bathrooms are just that way. Go out of the door, they're all the way at the back. And in the event of an emergency, we're just going to follow the very calm people who work here, and they are going to guide us through to the front forecourt area for an evacuation point. So before we get started, I would like to open our evening by welcoming Mel Grills up, who is ARUP's ANZ First Nation lead, to deliver our acknowledgement to country. Mel.
Hello, everyone. My name's Melanie Grills. I'm a Gomoroi or Kamilaroi person from Moree in New South Wales originally. I would like to begin by acknowledging the traditional custodians of the lands and waters on which we gather, the Gadigal people of the Eora Nation. I pay my respects to their elders past and present and extend that respect to all First Nations people joining us here and across the many countries connected through this live stream. Here on these shores, story and ceremony have unfolded for thousands of years. This harbour has always been a meeting place, a place of exchange, of deep knowledge, of balance between people and the living world. Long before words like climate action or sustainability were coined, the Gadigal people and the many nations across this continent were practicing them. Their systems of care and governance held the wisdom of how to live in reciprocity with country. As we gather today to talk about momentum, transformation, and the path to net zero, we must remember the road to net zero runs through First Nations lands. Every renewable project, every waterway restored, every design for resilience, each one intersects with country that has been cared for, studied and sustained for tens of thousands of years. Across this vast region, from desert to reef, from river to rainforest, our old people have long understood what circularity truly means, that nothing in nature is wasted and everything is connected. That same principle sits at the heart of the transformations we speak of today, designing systems that give back more than they take, guided by a relationship with country and the earth, not just a reliance on it. And as Asia Pacific looks to lead the global net zero charge, may we remember that true leadership starts with listening to those who have led environmental stewardship since time immemorial. That truth is more than a statement of geography, it's a truth of leadership, because Indigenous knowledge is not a stakeholder input, it is science, it is governance, it is climate strategy proven over millennia. So as we meet here in this place of light, sound and exchange, may we also tune in to the deeper story beneath our feet, the country, the earth itself, whose rhythms, languages and teachings continue to hold the answers we seek. May tonight's conversations be guided by humility and courage. May they reflect the wisdom that has always been here. And may the actions we take from this moment forward honour that ancient momentum, because the future we are building has always had its roots in the oldest continuing cultures on Earth. Thank you.
So important. Thank you, Mel, for your thoughtful acknowledgement of country. So, I'm a nerdy engineer and I'm passionate about lots of things, but one of them I'm really interested in is biomimetics, which is how do we use human creativity to basically copy nature and take nature's inspiration to come up with some amazing engineering solutions. And I've been really honoured to have been the host of Arab Sustainable Forces podcast, where I've had the privilege of engaging with many of the incredible minds that drive sustainability and change across our region. And it's a delight to bring that same spirit of curiosity and connection to tonight's event. If you haven't subscribed, by the way, to Sustainable Forces, this is my shameless plug. It is an amazing Arab podcast. It's a global podcast. Please like us, review us, subscribe to us, because we would love more seasons. We have just finished season 3, of which this will be the bonus episode going out. So you're all going to be famous on the podcast. So you should all download it. Which brings us perfectly to tonight's theme, which is how do we connect great minds and explore brave actions to reach our decarbonisation goals? And it's an interesting point in time that we meet. We've got change, uncertainty, and some geopolitics which are reshaping our global landscape. But some major economies are actually retreating from their net zero commitments. But here in the APEC region, we're seeing a delightful surge of leadership, collaboration, and innovation that gives me, and hopefully us, hope. It's an honour to be part of this conversation and even more of an honour to introduce our distinguished speakers who are going to be joining us on stage this evening. I'm going to introduce them by name and then I will invite them up later to give their 5-minute spiel. So joining us today is going to be Hilda Tonner, who is chair of the Arab Group Board, and she has flown all the way in from Oslo, Norway in Europe to be with us today. And we also have Zoe Witten, who is the managing director and head of strategy and impact at the Pollination Group, and she is a proud Sydney local. Now we are missing a body, sadly. You may have seen on the programme that we should have had Mark Sadler here, who is the Manager for Environment and Climate Change in the East Asia and Pacific region at World Bank. He was joining us from the US. He has spent 2.5 days trying to join us from the US. You may have noticed that Hurricane Melissa, which is one of the strongest storms ever recorded, kind of ironic seeing we're talking about a changing climate. Melissa, this amazing hurricane, has disrupted Mark's travels, and he spent 2.5 days mostly at airports from the East Coast to the West Coast of America, only to finally almost get across America to come here to have an engineering fault on his plane. And so, sadly, he is not joining us. But if you do ever see him, thank him for 2.5 hours of travel to nowhere, 2.5 days of travel to nowhere. So we will be missing a member, but that's okay because we're still going to be delightfully inspired by our two speakers. And for those of you who have joined us before, you will know that this event began 3 years ago here in the Sydney Opera House as it celebrated its 50th anniversary. And it symbolises a partnership that dates all the way back to the Opera House's inception, when Arabs engineers worked hand in hand with visionary architects to bring this masterpiece to life.
It's a relationship that's been built on creativity, resilience, and a shared commitment to shaping a sustainable future. And to reflect on that enduring partnership and to set the scene for tonight, please join me in welcoming Louise Herron, CEO of the Sydney Opera House.
Thank you, Michelle, and thank you so much as well for your lovely acknowledgement of country, which is so important. In fact, here we are meeting in the Yallamundi rooms and drawing exactly on what you were saying, Michelle, that Yallamundi, we chose this name at the as we were nearing completion of these rooms in 2019 as part of our decade of renewal, because Yallamundi means storytelling. And as you said, for tens of thousands of years, this has been a place of storytelling as well as gathering and celebration. And so it was really important to us to choose a name that symbolised our acknowledgement to that and our commitment to ensure that we continue that tradition today, as we are tonight, of storytelling and sharing and gathering and making sure that we can do what we can to make the world a better place. I'd like to give a very warm welcome to Arup Group Arup Group Limited Chair Hilda Tonner, who I had the pleasure of meeting with earlier today, and we are really looking forward to speaking to you shortly. You all know about Momentus that began several years ago to bring together thought leaders from industry, government, academia, and across community to explore how we can work towards a more sustainable future. And it is indeed, as you said, no accident that it is happening here, because this is the place of the shared vision of Arup and architect Jørn Utzon 70 years ago. Now, the bond between the two men certainly did fray towards the end of the project, but the ongoing partnership, and I'm always slightly reluctant to mention the name Utzon in Arup company, but I think it's important to do it because he was important and you're very important too. The bond, yes, did fray, but the bond between the Opera House and Arup has never been stronger as you continue to deliver on your commitment to total design, of which the Opera House is the exemplar. Most recently, Arup was part of the team that transformed the Concert Hall, our biggest venue during the decade of renewal, which we opened as part of our 50th anniversary in 2023. And as the ultimate 50th anniversary present, Arup gave the Opera House our first tactile model of the building, which you might have seen on your way in. The model has enhanced our audio-described performances and tours and ensures visitors who are blind or with low vision can more fully experience this extraordinary building. The Over Arup Foundation also continues to support some of the most impactful projects that we do in the Centre for Creativity, including our flagship Built Environment Learning Program, BUILD. The qualities that unite our two organisations, collaboration, clarity of thought, and creativity, are the same that unite everyone in this room tonight. At this time of geopolitical upheaval, transformative change, and existential uncertainty, it's never been more important to think big, to stand by our convictions, and to search for solutions that will affect us long into the future. Today we're going to be taking a deep dive into a timely topic, the transition to net zero, and how the Asia Pacific could or should be leading the way. It's a responsibility that falls naturally to us here at the Opera House, given that sustainability was built into this place from the very start. We also feel that sense of responsibility because we know that the Opera House stands alone on the world stage. Or as someone said, it's a megaphone with global reach, a masterpiece of creativity recognised around the world, and that means when we do something, people notice. We have a unique opportunity and a profound responsibility to lead by example, which is why the pathway to decarbonisation has been such an important part of our story in recent years. Since 2023, the Opera House has been powered by 100% renewable energy. We've invested in wind and solar in a way that supports the transition to renewables across the state more generally. And just a few months ago, we refurbished our green room kitchen, converting all the equipment in the kitchen to electric, an important part of our plan to become climate positive and to maintain our 6-star Green Star performance rating. And that wasn't a one-off. Subject to individual contracts with suppliers, we're hoping to see the same electrification transition taking place across all our kitchens by 2030. So the ideas are there. We just need the resources and the momentum to bring them to life. To continue to lead, we have to continue to dream big. And I'll give you another example. One of the exciting projects that we are considering at the moment is a battery storage proposal to power the Opera House, lower costs and reduce our emissions overall. The idea is to install a single battery, 3 to 5 megawatts, ideally on the forecourt, so that everyone can see it. That would contain enough power to run the Opera House in full show mode for up to 2 hours at a time when the wind isn't blowing or the sun isn't shining. And to make that happen, we're looking at a model to bring together the private sector, the public sector, and the wider community to work together to inspire positive change. Here's the thing. We're looking for funding. To support the feasibility of this project, and I'm sure that there are some people in this room who would just love to be part of that with us, as Arup already is. So we can achieve lasting and meaningful change, but that can only be achieved by working across sectors, cultural boundaries and physical boundaries. Collaborations and partnerships are key, and I am so excited to be tackling this long-standing challenge with Arup and some other lucky person in this room to, as we tackle our critical decarbonisation challenge. Thank you, Michelle. I'd love to hand back to you now. Thank you.
Thank you, Louise. And for those of you who are not yet subscribed to the Sustainable Forces podcast, season 2, episode 4 is with Louise, as she actually talks about the whole transition that you did at the Opera House, your leadership. Thank you for what you have done. It's a beautiful podcast. It is almost my favourite. It is tied top favourite. Not that you're supposed to have a favourite, but I do have a favourite. Tied top favourite with a season 3, episode 5, which happens to be where I interviewed TC Chu here, who is a managing director of Arup APAC, for those of you who don't know. Probably you are both joint tied for favourite episodes, but definitely worth listening to. You are creating a momentous moment. You are leading. The world is looking at what you're doing, and I really value your leadership in doing that. So we are joined tonight by so many extraordinary leaders, including yourself in the room, and we're going to approach decarbonisation from different unique perspectives, but we're united, I think, by a shared mission to drive real systemic change and to do it from this part of the world. So just giving you a heads up, this is how the evening is going to unfold. In a minute, I'm going to invite each of our speakers to come up and they're going to give a 5-minute speech to you. I'm very strict on time, so it'll only be 5 minutes. And then we're going to do a Q&A session. Now, this Q&A session is for you. There are going to be roving microphones in this room ready for you to ask your questions to our panelists. So I'm giving you that so you can be curating your questions, because I will be picking on you in a second. So now you know what's coming. It is my pleasure to welcome our first speaker. So Hilda Tonner brings extensive leadership experience in the energy and infrastructure markets, most recently as CEO of Statnett, Norway's transmission system operator. Before that, she served as executive director and chief innovation officer with Ramboll Group, as a non-executive chair of both the Research Council of Norway and the Husfund, a Norwegian energy utility. And her international career also includes time in Thailand as an executive director for a leading telecommunications company. So she's going to give us not only her Eurocentric ideas, but also an idea around her experience in Asia Pacific. Please join me in welcoming Hilda Tonne to the stage.
Thank you, Michelle, and thank you, Louise, for having us. I have to say, this is a very special moment for me in this iconic building. On behalf of Arup, I'm very humbled and also extremely proud. And the tour we had today of this building, it's heartwarming to hear our engineers talking about this together with your people. It's amazing. I will share with you some of my experiences from the Nordics and from Europe and try to apply that to the world, but also, obviously, APAC as such. And let me start by saying the following. It used to be about climate and morale. It used to be about the climate crisis that we are in the middle of. Now it is, in a volatile world, about energy security. It's about reindustrialization and economic growth. It's about affordability for people in our communities. And it's about the climate crisis. So it is still about the climate crisis, but it's about everything we do and everything that we're part of, in addition to that. And a lot has already happened. A lot is already done, some would say. Being a Nordic person, having been in the Nordic and European energy transition, my experience started especially with the energy crisis in Europe. When the Russians started to withdraw their gas, we had the war in Ukraine starting, we had a dry spell all over Europe, and the whole energy crisis came creeping upon us. It was really, really difficult. And then the whole world actually experienced it over time. What happened then was that EU dived into Repower EU, which was a program that drove the pace of investments in renewable energy. Very successfully, they also got used to living without Russian gas, independent from Russian gas. They also got used to more and more being independent from fossil fuel as such. Actively also working on the market system, considering whether or not this deregulated market system we have for the power system in Europe is actually working, because it was crisis. It was difficult for people. And they ended up with a good solution. We would continue to be deregulated in the market as we had been. It was about independence, it was about competitiveness, it was about energy security and the climate crisis. And renewables grew from 38% to 40%, 47% of the EU's electricity generation the 4 years the crisis went on. Great success. If I relate this to Australia, I don't know that much about this market, but I do know that you currently have a share of 38% of the generation supply being renewable. You have a target of 82%, and there's a huge discussion about that. I know that, and I look forward to discussing that later. You also have established renewable energy zones, which is quite impressive and quite targeted, and 43 potential renewable energy zones nationally is something to be had, if it happens. And then, of course, it's APAC. Let's take that perspective. 60% of the world's population, 60% of the world's carbon emission, actually. The five largest emitters in the world is in this region. And at the same time, you can see solutions in APAC because of when you have 60% of the population, you also have the skills, you have huge technology drivers, and you have opportunities to be part of the solution. And if APAC is not part of the solution, there will be no solution for the world, in my view. And then to the world, we do believe, and we do discuss all the time, that this is highly difficult. And are we really moving? Well, let me point to the think tank Energy and Climate Intelligence Unit. They have an analysis that they just summed up, the Paris Agreement 10 years after. A couple of points. Solar and wind now accounts for more than 90% of new global electricity capacity additions. And clean power is 40% of the global electricity generation. Already. Renewables have overtaken coal and coal share in the global electricity mix by the first half of this year. Solar and wind generation growth is now outpacing the demand growth globally. And in 2024, the renewables deployment helped to avoid $400 to $500 billion in fossil fuel costs. So it's happening, ladies and gentlemen, in the world. So what can we achieve by this? First of all, what can be electrified will be electrified. I'm absolutely sure that will happen worldwide. And in Europe, we will move from 20% today to more than 50% into the 2050 net zero. In Australia, you could say you would move from 30% electrification today to 60% in 2050, if you deliver on your targets. And coming from Norway, and having Sweden as a neighbor, we would move from approximately being the most electrified countries in the world today, 50% electrified, towards 80%. So it is, targets are set, the world will go and be electrified. And what will we achieve with that? We will achieve a lower energy price by 30%. We will achieve energy security through having local renewable energy generation close to us, safe and independent of low fossil fuel imports. And the imports in the scenarios I see in Europe is that it will go from 60% today down to 30% closer to 2050. And then economic growth will be there based on lower prices and reindustrialization. And the emissions will be probably reduced by 80% given the scenario I'm referring to here. So everything is great. It will work. But what does it take? How do we get there? My main point today is to point at the following. We have delivered on power generation. We have delivered on renewables. And we will continue to do that. Investments are okay. Yeah, we can discuss the cost level of offshore wind till we're blue in the face, but it's still there. But let me describe how Norway, through the last decades, have operated a renewable system. We could never have done that over the last 40 years without thinking cross-border flexibility, without thinking storage, and without thinking massive investments in grids, in addition to the power generation. So our thinking in the Nordics, and now it's dawning on the world, you will not have transition without transmission. You need the grid. And I think the world has forgotten that to a certain extent. We're waking up now. That is going to take a balancing act, because if you invest in renewable energy, you will never do that where you need the energy. The nature of the renewable energy is it needs to be distributed. So if you accept that, you need the grid and you need storage and you need to balance the energy in that grid every nanosecond of the day. And that's hard work done by the TSOs today. We need massive investments in this. We need approximately 2,500 billion euros of total investments in EU or in Europe as such up against 2050. That's 100 billion euros yearly. And if we do this, that's not the only thing that needs to happen. A whole mindset shift needs to happen. We need anticipatory investments. We need timely investments. We need new permitting ways of moving quicker. We need regulatory frameworks that is inviting for private capital in order to do those investments. And we need pace. This is coming from a place where none of that is happening today. So to the APEC opportunity. I'm seeing APEC as a region that has the opportunity to leapfrog with its diversity all the way from China to Southeast Asia via Australia, East Asia as such. It can do the same. But it doesn't have to go through all the boring steps that Europe and other markets have done before them. And I'm thinking the diversity, the skills, the closeness to one of the largest supply chains in the world with China, the pace that you see in parts of this region will actually give you the opportunity to leapfrog. And without that happening, I'm pretty sure it will not happen. So my challenge to APAC is take that challenge, do some leapfrogging, learn from the mistakes and the learnings that the rest of us have done, and move quicker towards the target. Thank you so much for your attention.
Next, I would like to invite to the stage Zoe Whitten, who is Managing Director and Head of Strategy and Impact at Pollination Group. She's an award-winning advisor in sustainable finance and climate risk and works with institutional investors to integrate climate strategy, governance and analytics, helping the finance sector mobilise towards a decarbonised economy. She also serves as Chair of the Centre for Policy Development. She sits on the board of the Investor Group on Climate Change and advises both the government's National Hydrogen Strategy and the Powering the Regions Fund. Please join me in welcoming Zoe Whitten.
Thank you so much, and thanks for having me. And I assume I don't need to do this one because I've got this one grand. I really don't like these ones because for some of those of you who are taller, it's a slouch town. And thanks for having me, including here at this particular building. My father is an Asian mechanical engineer, and so you had better believe that I had the book about this building and this company by the time I was about 15. So I've been asked to give some reflections on how transition is playing out globally, and I can tell you some headline stats, which include that we are seeing some policy pullback almost entirely, though, in the States, and that policy pullback comes at the end of a very long, slow walk up a very big hill, but I'll get to that. But I'm going to talk about Asia particularly. One of my parents is Southeast Asian. I've covered Asia, worked in Asia, and lived in Asia for most of my, on and off, for most of my life, and one of my major shareholders is now Asian as well. And in this context, this messy global context, I want to talk about Asia particularly and start with Asia and ask, to Hilda's question, what works? How do we get there? And I'm going to start with an anecdote. So when the UNFCCC held COP15 in Copenhagen in 2009, the task was to sign the successor to the Kyoto Protocol, which was expiring the year after with nothing in its wake. And I was 21, and the negotiations failed at the 11th hour. Wen Jiabao was leading a broader group and decided that they didn't like what had been put forward in the negotiating room by Obama. And when Obama flew out, they shut down traffic in the entire city. And that meant that when we learned of the negotiations failing, we were stuck in a train tunnel underground between Malmo and Copenhagen, which is underneath the strait, surrounded by crying youth delegates. A very teary train. And one of my senior colleagues at the time, who will remain unnamed, said to me, the Chinese have decided not to support the deal because they don't have the manufacturing base built yet, but they will. And I was pre-2 economics degrees by then, at that point, and so I thought that's a nice conspiratorial thing to distract me from how totally bummed I am about this, and went on to a really big, slightly heartbroken night in Copenhagen. Wind the clocks forward, February 2025. Sarah Barker, my colleague, and I are scratching our heads following Trump's inauguration, and we're trying to sort out what to say to our clients, who are some of the biggest financials on earth. We went back to look at history, and in that history, we found three curves. The first curve is a curve which describes the US, and it looks like a sine wave. In 1992, the US ratifies the UNFCCC and commits to leadership on climate. In 2001, Bush withdraws the US from Kyoto, calling it fatally flawed. In 2015-16, Obama then pushes hard for Copenhagen first, and then commits to Paris. In 2017, Trump withdraws and rolls back US commitments. In 2021, Biden rejoins. In 2023, the IRA is minted. In 2024, guess what happens? Trump signals he's going to pull out of Paris. In 2025, Trump pulls out of Paris and scraps the IRA and defunds many, many things besides. That's a wave that gets taller and it gets faster. So that's the first curve. The second curve is the global curve, and it looks very different. It looks like a very long, slow hike up a difficult hill. I could read out various thresholds on that curve to you, probably bore you terribly, but the headline is that in 1992, it starts with the UNFCCC, that in 2019, 19% of global emissions are covered by national targets. By 2023, this is 90%. The number of countries, states, major cities, and major companies with commitments has walked up a hill which looks roughly the same shape since then. And this walk up largely continues, including in the last three quarters of 2025, except largely in the US. Perhaps the clearest threshold on that curve is that 195 countries have committed to Paris in 2015, and since then one has exited twice. Now, I'll give you, the US is a really big chunk of emissions to come out of that set of commitments that's fallen out in the last year. But China is about twice as large, and 30 days ago they set the first national absolute decline target they've ever set. So this brings me to the third curve, and this is the Chinese curve. Perhaps the reason the US curve is so loopy lately, China's curve is not a J curve, but it's pretty intimidating. So in 1992, starts with the UNFCCC. It's visually similar to a lot of other countries if you go between here and 2005. In 2005, China publishes its National Renewable Energy Law and ramps up what will end up being a two-decade-long renewables investment campaign. Until last month, China had never set an absolute national decline target, but in 2021, they set themselves a 1.2 terawatt target for 2030, and then they hit it in 2024. Spoilers. By early 2025, China is home to between 70 and 95% of manufacturing capability across all renewable subsectors, and 76% of all investment in that sector globally. I can go on, but you know this story. You see it in the headlines. It's very clear that China has approached this transition informed by economic advantage and risk. When we think about our experience in Asia more broadly, and pollination is largely based in APAC, it did look like a slow start. But today, we see some of the most competitive jurisdictions on the map for the machines, the tech, and the materials needed for transition, and some of the most creative transition and adaptation efforts, including financing. It's a slow, steady, and valuable transition, conducted with an eye to a very real economic risk and opportunity which is playing out over the next 100 years. In response to a recent piece of work by Bloomberg about the portion of economic growth which is now driven by disasters, JP Morgan's head of climate advisory noted that climate change is like a crystal ball, an unusual one, because you actually get to know what happens in the future. Most of the time, we don't. And so far, Asia has taken good advantage of that visibility. So I go back to my conversation on that very teary train about a week before Christmas in 2015, and all I'll say about it is age before beauty. When we put the curves together, we see an aggressive pullout from the US inside what looks like a more gentle global transition. We see most of Asia pushing forward on both transition and adaptation, and we might get a chance to talk about that later. And those actions aren't just normative, they're economic. The point I want to make is to follow Hilda's point and zoom out a little bit. The first part of the curves I described, whether it is the US climbing in and out of the early stages of commitments, or the rest of the world slowly beginning to climb a hill, that's the aspiration bit. It's the commitment bit. It's the political bit. It's the consensus-making bit. But the right-hand side of those curves, where we are now, that's the beginning, or maybe not just the beginning of the economic bit, the structural change bit, the real climate risk that you have to live through bit, the persistent economic advantage that comes from setting policy settings and investing for decades bit. It is a messy, various, and centrally commercial part. It is not a nice, neat set of collected commitments. It is not a peaceful or uniform set of trade agreements. So, to the opening question, how do we get this done? In Asia, it's been a slow and steady build of advantage. China has been fast, but it has not been alone. It's economic foundations and political foundations. And so I would ask you all not to make the mistake of seeing this as a normative project only. To steal Louise's phrase, people are noticing that Asia is starting to lead by example. And I say Asia and I hope I mean APAC, including us. So I would say to everyone, please keep it up.
Thank you, Zeri. Lots of food for thought there. So in a second, I'm going to invite our panellists up for some Q&A, and this is where we're going to open it out to the floor. So get ready if you do have some questions. We do have two roving microphones that will go around. But before we do that, can I please invite Hilda and Zoe to join me in the hot seats? I feel like we've gone, I mean, your statement was transition will not happen without transmission, and I love that. And we're still going up the hill, even if it's in a sine wave. I love that too. Hilda, what you said is very relevant. I saw that Bill Gates yesterday made an announcement that we need to prevent this climate alarmist mentality that we're going through. And, you know, we talk about eco-anxiety and young people who feel like they can't do anything right. And he said, instead, we have to make sure we're also focusing on human welfare. Mm-hmm. And I feel like that's sort of your messaging. Do you want to elaborate on that?
No, to me, this has become, and not only to me, but I think this has become a discussion among people, real people, and people living in societies. And we talk about policy resistance, we talk about things are not really happening, we discuss whether this and that is a wise thing to do. Do we believe in the climate effect? Is there a crisis? I think that discussion is becoming less and less interesting. I think what we need to talk about is how do we shape a better world, to talk Arab? Mm-hmm. How do we move our societies into very concrete electrified power systems? How do we move our societies into sustainable ways of living? It's going to take changes. It's going to take massive investments. It's going to take new ways of thinking. But we will be out on the other side, which is in a good way for people and societies. Mm. It's about economic growth. It's about how people can afford it. It's about competitiveness and security. Mm. And that's much more than climate morale.
Mm-hmm. Zoe, I liked your sine wave analogy because it gave us some perspective on what it seems like quite a turbulent time in the US right now. But actually, as you're showing, is just sort of this bipolar sort of movement towards what we know is happening in China. Now, we know the US is talking about they want to make America great. It's all about building their economy. But to build an economy, you have to have a competitive advantage. And one of the things I think that China is doing really well is leading in competitive advantage around innovation, electrification, AI. They're really working in that tech space. Do you think that is going to force the US to perhaps shift more towards the innovation and where China is sort of leading in that space? Base in order to be competitive, because consumers are going to surely want to purchase things that make them feel better.
I wish I could say yes. I wish I could say yes, but I almost feel like we're at the moment living through the bit after that bit, which is when you didn't build the competitive advantage and everything that people would like to buy does have a supply chain that goes into China, and you are having to wrangle with the political consequences of that using different tools. Right, rather than using tools which have been in the works in China and in other places for a number of decades. Hilda, you talked about Norway, and we had done a set of policy. You were talking about Scandinavia generally and the experience of the energy transition in Scandinavia. We did some research a couple of years ago that looked at who had done what where and what had worked, basically. And one of the most striking things was that some of the places that had worked, and Scandinavia was one of those places, you were talking about two or three decades worth of policy stability that had been underpinned by investment and directional research programs. And the United States has done that on a bunch of things. You know, that's the Mag 7 and not American for no reason. But by the same token, the United States has not done that on this. Mm-hmm. And so when China has carved itself out a niche in this. One of the things I didn't talk about earlier is that in about 2022, 2023, we see a flip in Chinese aid and development spending into Southeast Asia, away from conventional technologies, and suddenly it's all renewables. Yep. So that capacity is being exported as a political good into the region, as a relational good into the region. That program's been underway for a very long time. So I would love to be able to say at the US, which has got massive innovation engines. And one of the places that we was on our list of places that had done this really well was California, because the policy development and funding system for electric vehicles in California is extraordinary, probably second to none. I'd love to say that that is going to see that world. It's going to go, actually, I can run up those hills. I've run up a lot of those other hills and have a crack at it. But right now, I feel like we're living in the moment when you actually don't feel secure to do that. And so you use other mechanisms at your disposal to try and block out that competitive advantage and pretend that it doesn't persist. But it does.
Doesn't this, and I fully agree with you, doesn't this show us that this is going to take holistic, long-term thinking? Where we think broadly how to get there and also talk about how to get out on the other side in a positive way. Talk to people about that.
And isn't it crazy that we as humans, we all live on this one planet and yet we think that we can do different things in our own little patch of it, not understanding that we're all connected. Anyway, okay. Sorry, I'm supposed to be opening to this to the audience too. Does anybody from the audience have a question for either of our panelists before I continuing rambling on? Oh, we have a couple of questions here.
A question, I think, to both of the panelists. You were speaking, Hilda, about transmission and the importance of getting the transmission network right and the investment that's required into the transmission network, which is a real challenge for Australia. I'm interested in, as we think about the prioritisation of that and the extra capacity that's now being taken by data centres, and I wondered if you have any comments on that and how governments might tackle that challenge.
Yeah, thank you.
That's actually two questions, I think. I'll start with transmission and the cost of doing that or our ability to do it. I would still point to, first of all, nothing's going to happen unless you do it. So this is a big blocker currently, and we need to, we have to do it in order to get there. Having acknowledged that, if we had invested in infrastructure earlier, everything else would actually be more bankable. If we start now with a higher pace, it's going to take such an amount of investment. So I'm a true believer in PPP, in public-private partnerships. Mm. You need to do something in order to get private investments in there in a very highly, extremely regulated sector with regulation frameworks from the 1960s, not thinking about private investments, where the current tariff models and the financial models and the business models are actually building up to underinvestment. We need to turn that around in order to make it happen. And Australia has to do that as well. So that's a learning in the Nordics, that's a learning in Europe, and it's absolutely a discussion in Australia, I know that. So it's going to take holistic thinking and politics and large, long-term plans. Not easy, but it needs to happen. Data centers. I'm in full understanding of the discussion, and there is a dilemma, because data centers do not necessarily create jobs or industrial development the way we used to look at it. And they are extremely, craving for power and water, actually, and solutions around them. So, first of all, I think we have to acknowledge that there will be no decarbonization or AI or digital of the world without data centers. This is at the center of the solution. Having said that, I think when we do this, we need to think holistically. We need to think society. We need to link decisions about industrial developments around the data centers. And we need to see it in a total planning, so that it doesn't happen in wacko ways. And we already do that in Europe. We advise on that. So it is possible. But it needs to do it in accordance with societal development.
I'm going to add to that, and I will leave Hilda's comment to stand on data centres generally, but we'll pick up the total planning point, because I do think it's also, as you've noted, very relevant for transmission. In Australia, I saw some amazing research yesterday, which isn't published yet, but was also terrible because it had Australia ranked on time for approval of new energy projects compared to other major jurisdictions. And you guys can all guess what that looks like. It's a bad picture right now. It's a really bad picture. So I've just talked aspirationally about how Australia is part of Asia and we're doing this great stuff. But when it comes to that stuff, we're just not in the ballpark of success there at all.
You're not alone.
Yeah, we're not alone, but we're leading the pack of bad, I think. But we this point about thinking total planning is interesting, because one of the challenges that we keep coming up with various counterparties, I sit on the board of the Net Zero Economy Authority, which is the transition authority for at Australia's federal level. And we just keep coming up with a problem of how do you run the approval system when you're trying to do 38 different things at once? And the approval system often includes 5 or 6 different entities or layers or concerns or whatever it happens to be. And the approval system is chock full of all of the things that are happening, including the data centers. And trying to run the approval system from the direction of everyone who has a project idea should go and do the work and do the thing and have a punt, and maybe you're going to get through the process. And you have to engage the communities while you do that, which in some cases sort of terrorizes them, frankly, is not working for us. It's not working here. And so this point about holistic planning and indeed regional transition plans, I'm putting my NZEA hat on here, is I think going to be a really important thing for us in Australia, because we can't just make incremental changes to our approvals regime if transmission is needed for transition, which it definitely is here, because incremental changes, we don't need a step change, we need a qualitative change. We need an order of magnitude change in our speed and our ability to get those things approved. So I want to reinforce the total planning piece, because I think it's going to become more and more part of our reality as we try and do many things quickly at once.
And I have a very concrete example, Statnet, that I used to lead. We established 10 area plans of the country of Norway. You could do the same in Australia. That actually works. Mm. That's a very practical advice.
Mm. I think there's a lot of talk around AI right now, and everybody's starting to use it, and you ChatGPT, and you're worried about energy and water. So I'm all about, what can I do today? So here's a tip for all of you in the audience. AI processes on tokens, which can be part of words, and every token it processes consumes energy and water. And so Sam Altman from OpenAI said, please stop being so polite to humans, because every time you say please, thank you, or have politeness when you are asking your ChatGPT to figure out what you're having for dinner tonight, you're actually processing a token, which costs energy. So basically just be rude, I think, and then we can all save some energy. Okay, sir.
Oh, I'm not sure that's the spirit. My name is Sven Rogge, and I'm from the University of New South Wales. And I would like to talk about energy generation. Energy is linked to productivity. We need more of it. We need it at a decent price. We want fossils out of the grid as fast as we can. What is your take on gas in that context?
I can start? Mm. My take on gas, natural gas, is that I see it still as a transition. The transition part of fossil fuel. But very, very quickly, I see it as 10% of the total energy mix, only taking the peaks.
But that's the issue. It's the marginal cost that the marginal supply will dictate the cost of the energy, and the energy of gas is expensive. So how do we deal with that?
I think a lot of the cost in that transition is about backup. It's about resilience. That's what you, yeah. And to get that resilience, you need to keep the natural gas. That's what I mean by peaking. You need to have that as backup. You need to keep some gas turbines there for those 2 days when the balancing of the grid is difficult, to be very concrete. So I believe in that, but not much more than that.
And how do we balance that with getting coal out of the grid and getting renewables into the grid as fast as possible?
Well, coal is a very Australian issue. I'm going to leave that to you.
Unfortunately, I'm not a grid specialist, so I'm not going to do a good job of answering that particular question about the coal piece, because it is a distinctly Australian issue, yes, or a Japanese issue. if you feel that way inclined as well. It's actually, maybe I should say it's a distinctive to some of the Asian grids. But I do want to say something about gas, this piece on gas, right? Because I think, and as I say, I'm not a grid expert, so I rely on other people's research in this for the largest part. I have spent an unfortunate amount of my time having to do gas forecasts out into the ASEAN region because it's very, very important for a bunch of big Australian companies. And one of the things that's interesting about those is that it all points in a sort of similar direction over different time horizons. But the point about the incremental cost is interesting, and it's particularly interesting when it flows up to the question, particularly in Australia, about investment in supply. Because we have an issue at the moment with cost of gas here and in Asia. The intention is to use it in those systems in a very specific way. There is a transition process, which at the moment is bumpy as all get out for us and quite challenging. And in all of that, there's a very strong argument that happens here, which says get as much as you can because you don't. It's expensive and you're going to need it for a while and Asia's going to need a bunch of it, so just go for it. That argument's been really hard to unpick because today most of that gas is not used for that transition type activity. So one of the things that I see, and this is a bit of a hobby horse, so you have apologies here, but it's such a central issue, and I've been tortured by the gas conversation for most of my career now, I think we are likely to start to need a certificate of use for gas, because it is likely that we will continue to use gas, including in Asian grids, for decades and decades and decades, and we will continue to need to develop supply for that. But that doesn't mean that we should continue to develop supply for absolutely every piece of gas on the planet. There's a lot of gas that's going to come out of the Middle East in the next 2 or 3 years as all of those systems flip on. If the US keeps developing and they keep continuing to expand their export programs, then that's going to be gas onto the global market as well. You don't need all of it. So the question of which bits do you need and can you carve out the bits that are used for transition activities that you know are relevant to you at different points in your transition?
I think you can. And I think otherwise it's going to be expensive.
Yeah. And can you direct financing to that? Can you direct financing away from other things? Can you make sure the gas is used for those purposes? I think we're going to need that level of sophistication in our gas market.
Thank you. We will have a question here. Is there one on this side of the room? Can we get a microphone over there next? But I'll start with you, please. Yeah. No, you can do your question first.
Now?
Yeah.
Thank you. Hi, my name is Vidya Basarkot. I'm from Covi, a Danish consultancy firm, just like Arup. We are talking about APAC. Of course, the region has some developed economies, but it also has many developing, emerging economies. And I'm particularly interested to talk about India, where I come from. Most of the solutions that we hear about green transition, net zero, for a country like India, do not help because they are taken from some other environment at a different point in time. And if we apply that to an emerging economy like India, of course, without India, we can't be really a sustainable planet. That's why I'm interested to know what are those solutions you think can help countries like India leapfrog into green transition? Mm. I'm not sure if the planet can wait till 2070 when we have the target. So some practical solutions, when I seek these. Of course, my company is a Scandinavian country. But still, the solutions are not practical. Mm. Either we do not understand what an emerging economy like India requires, or the solutions that are given are not really applicable. So anything from the panel, I would really appreciate.
Thank you, Vidya. This is very much part of my thinking for APAC or for India as such. I think India is a very good example. First of all, India is a country, or developing countries should learn from the inertia that is part of the power system in Europe and also other places in the world, where things have moved, again, with a basis in regulatory frameworks from the 60s, there's a will to do things extremely slowly because we have models that puts the burden of payment to the consumers. So we would like to underinvest. I think if for India to leapfrog, I would, and it probably sounds a bit cocky, but I would actually focus on investing in the infrastructure in a timely manner, because then you will make everything else much more bankable. And I would... That means anticipatory investments. It means timely invest, forward-looking investments on the grid, which is the bottleneck, on storage, in the system as such. Go directly to the target instead of discussing things, you know, doing things the old-fashioned way that we have done the last decades. That's the possibility for a developing country like India.
Do you see a lot of potential in India adopting to this solution?
Absolutely. You have a grid which is... The grid you have is not... that good. And you have places where there is no grid. And India is in need of a plan for developing that grid. And I'm pretty sure when you do that, you have a base, an infrastructure basis that will make other projects and initiatives bankable compared to what we do. We do it the opposite way in the rest of the world.
I would just add to that, not from the investment perspective rather than the grid perspective. One of the things that transition is driving in Asia is a flourishing and a level of excitement around blended finance that, you know, it's fun. haven't seen this like it before. But in the context that Hilda's just talked about, where you sort of say, look, one of the things that people have done well when they've been able to do it is actually stick to their guns for a while and pre-invest so that when you need the infrastructure, it's there, which is hard. It's hard to leverage that investment in the developing country context as well. Sitting in next to ASEAN, there is an opportunity, I think, there on the level of enthusiasm around blending that is coming from governments and MDBs across the region, but also from the interest, some from Northeast Asia, and I'm particularly thinking about Japan, in investing in growth and transition, both as a growth opportunity, but also a learning opportunity outside of the jurisdiction. There's a combination of investment factors coming together there, which potentially could support overcoming some of the natural challenges to some of that early investment which are going to exist, which will be getting the capital together, getting it at scale, and getting it committed so that it doesn't just have to come from local sources. Because there's a significant interest. China's not the only counterparty who is now trying to invest in and put forward transition technologies across region. You know, Japan is into it as well in a really big way. So I observe opportunities there from the investment side as well.
I fully agree. And I have an analogy, actually. Norway came into oil and gas in the 70s as a fairly poor country. Mm. We today have probably the most modern, fancy regulatory basis for developing and producing oil and gas in the most efficient and sustainable way in the world. So that regulatory framework for Norway leapfrogged. And that basis is working perfectly. We kind of forgot the power part, except for the deregulation, which was a good thing. Mm.
There's a question over here.
Hopefully this is working, yeah. So I'm Julian Soper from Arup. I lead our science and industry business in ANZ. I'm really heartened to hear what you said about APAC. Sort of leading the charge in a way, particularly China. And sort of you have to admire actually what they've done in terms of technology and competitive advantage. And the question for me is around what we need to do in Australia to sort of mimic that. And one of the things that troubles me is particularly around the renewable technology coming into the country is the circular economy needs that are going to come from that, from batteries, solar panels, etc. And really, we have such a small industry here, and really, you know, we've let our manufacturing base disappear over a number of years. And I'm sort of really interested to know, and particularly in the Norwegian context, it probably has a similar sized population, or a small population comparatively.
Much smaller.
Smaller. But compared to China, we're a small population, or most of Asia, actually. So, you know, what is it that Australia needs to do to maintain its competitive or maximise its competitive advantage to the rest of the world in terms of our manufacturing base and, you know, how we're actually going to deliver on all of this and how we're going to, you know, meet our circular economy sort of principles?
I can start.
Mm.
First of all, I think, and I might shock people now, but I think the closeness you have to the world's largest most developed supply chain here in Australia is a very positive thing. Geography way closed, trade closed, that's a good thing. And we all know that China's manufacturing is probably there to stay. It's not going to go away.
Mm.
And they are delivering some of the best manufacturing supply chains in the world. Europe can start investing now in certain things. Other regions can do the same. But China will not be beaten. It's not possible, not even by Australia. So I wouldn't go there. But I'd say China is there to stay. You have a closeness to that supply chain. You have good relations in trade with that supply chain. So that's a positive. And then other things I would look upon as very positive in Australia, taking this transition, is you have area. You have solar. You have wind. You have the greatest opportunity to do things in a planned and holistic way with that supply chain nearby, learning from what others have done around you. So I have high hopes and for Australia. I think this will work. You can also move from a very coal-heavy, fossil fuel-heavy economy and leapfrog maybe even more than anyone else in have done in Europe.
Mm. I always love the contrast of anyone who is not from Australia talking in Australia about the renewables opportunity here, because everyone else is like, wow,
it is.
Those are some amazing resources. But I take the point about the, you know, how does Australia participate in that in a way that builds wealth and advantage and well-being here, not just in a way that relies on a lot of other bits of competitive advantage which are developed by others. And I think the point that Hilda makes about the supply chain is a good and interesting one, because as Asia is switching on to this, we had the fun time about 12 months ago of refreshing the National Hydrogen Strategy. That was timely. But one of the things that was in debate in that conversation was the level of demand that we were going to see. And Japan has an import target, I think it's 8 megs by 2032 or something totally outrageous. But there, all of that work that's happening up there to do transition, to build the opportunity, is all work that Australia flows into as well. So we are obviously the other end of a supply chain there. Mm-hmm. And there is a strengthening of those supply chains that I think is central for us because, as you note, we don't have a big population. So we're not going to build a big manufacturing base to serve our own population locally. We probably need to knit ourselves into and continue to knit ourselves into that regional supply chain to access that volume. So that being the case, I would say there's a bit of a dance, because the thing I always go to first is to connect with demand. So we talk a lot in Australia about financing. We have we have 5 separate major special investment vehicles that operate on climate change with overlapping mandates. And then on top of that, we have something like 70 other financing exercises or vehicles that touch on bits and pieces of climate change in other ways. We spend a lot of time thinking about funds that we're going to announce that are going to help us become a manufacturing superpower, do the leap from all the rest of it. Demand, connecting to demand, and whether that demand is offshore or whether it is onshore, or whether it is government demand, is one of the most important things we can do to stand up activity, manufacturing activity here. And the demand needs to be steady and it needs to be nonpartisan. I was quite struck talking to some colleagues in New Zealand earlier this week about the process of the national infrastructure plan that they're building there, which I didn't know about. But the purpose of it basically is to say, can we please stop whipsawing from one government to another and just dropping projects all over the place? We need a nonpartisan plan for what our development is going to look like here, and it needs to be steady. And in a plan like that, you could put a local procurement requirement if you wanted to address the manufacturing and the local value add piece. But the last thing I'd say on it is that for some parts of the world, and this is the dance, right? China is an incredible supply chain for us. But for some parts of the world, we are safe in a world that's getting less safe and less predictable and less comfortable and all the rest of it. And that is a demand opportunity for us, which I know that we're working very hard to take advantage of. Mm. But that's a dance.
Yeah, but that's a great point, I think, because you are safe, and close to a big supply chain at the same time. One thing I was thinking about that we learned from Norway, we also come from a fossil fuel country. And at least we like to think that the competence we have built up and the technology knowledge we have built up through that industry is transferable to build a renewable manufacturing business and services business. That is something clearly something Australia can think about as well.
Thank you. There's a question right here.
Thank you. My name's Craig Rusak. I'm from Buildings Alive. Firstly, acknowledge the Sydney Opera House, as was mentioned. The great leadership in understanding time of energy use and linking to wind and solar generation and so forth. It's absolutely phenomenal. It's the best in this country. And it leads into my question. I wanted to perhaps sharpen the focus. The question about India is something I think about a lot. So I was told, I believe this is correct, there's about a billion ceiling fans in India, right? And they're about 85 watts each. So that's 85 gigawatts of ceiling fans in India, which is about three times our national electricity market thereabouts in Australia. So just in ceiling fans. If you changed a ceiling fan to a split system air conditioning unit, will you increase its electricity demand by about 20 times? Mm-hmm. So that fan all of a sudden is 20 times more. So if you did that by a billion, you've got obviously a pretty significant problem, right? And so I guess why I want to sharpen the focus on that a little bit is the whole well-being, welfare. We've got more extreme weather. We've got, you know, dangerous temperatures in evenings. So it would make sense if you could afford it to get a split system air conditioning unit for your house wherever you live in India, and just to get by. And what does that mean? And can infrastructure really even address that if it might be only for 2 hours a day that you might run that in the early evening just to keep your family safe?
I don't think you should choose. I think we should find solutions that are about energy efficiency is obviously part of this. And I never like to put things up against each other because we're in a situation where we have to do everything. So, yes, great examples, opportunities, energy efficiency is very much a part of it. And then we need to build grids.
Can I add to that? You said something earlier, Hilda, about you need to think about a world that is better when you've done it in lots of ways. You're talking about well-being at the outset. We haven't talked much about adaptation. But I talk about adaptation in this context because there is a version of that energy build that says it's both inevitable and almost unbearable for the energy system that it's in, if that's the way you have to solve the problem. India is an extraordinary example of just an acute adaptation challenge, just acute, extraordinary. I don't know how many of you read Cli-Fi, which is climate-related science fiction, but there's a famous... There were a few faces there, people were like, what is she talking about?
Including me.
Yeah. One of the famous early additions to the genre by a very famous author starts with a heat wave in India that kills a million people and sets off unilateral geoengineering, which is a sci-fi, but they picked India for a reason. I don't know if you guys ever use earth.nullschool. It's a live map of all weather on Earth. It has wind, waves, heat, wind, speed on every part of the Earth. You can literally roll the globe around and have a look at it. It's my favorite site on the whole internet. And if you log into it in about July or August, and during, you know, 4 or 5 o'clock in the afternoon here, maybe 9 o'clock in the evening, and you roll it up over India and you look at the temperatures up there, it's extraordinary. Mm. It's absolutely extraordinary. And if you just try and solve that with an energy grid, I think you're going to fail. Mm. And the reason I started with your comment, Hilda, about build a world that is better when you're in it after you've done the work, is because some of the adaptation measures we're starting to see in Asia are better. Everything is better after you do them. So not just you've taken the additional impact of climate risk and you've ameliorated it somewhat. You've often made places easier to live, cleaner, more accessible, often more expensive, which is a bit of an issue when you do it in certain cities. But there are some extraordinary solutions that we're seeing coming out of Asia, and some of them weren't even adaptation solutions to start off with. So that's one thing I'd add to that conversation, because the efficiency piece is essential, the grid build is essential, the financing is essential, but you're going to have to do systematic adaptation over the top of that. And we are starting to see some really extraordinary solutions in that space, and it's better after you've done it.
I fully agree. And I think Arup is a very good example of seeing everything you can do through what we deliver in infrastructure, in buildings, in innovative solutions as such, holistic and targeted in everything we do. This is part of everything we do. So adaptation is part of it, efficiency is part of it, investment in infrastructure is part of it, generation is part of it. And that's why I think the discussion sometimes get derailed, because people are putting things up against each other. This is probably the most holistic discussion we need to have. This is about everything. It's part of everything.
Thank you. We have a question over here. Hi.
Good evening. My name is Robin Mellon. I'm CEO of Better Sydney, and I'm deputy chair for the UN Global Compact Network in Australia. I'd be interested in the panel's perspectives, I guess, from Europe and APAC on how we move towards and support and establish supply chains for solar panels and renewable energy solutions that are free from human rights violations and modern slavery. Sorry to slide that can of whoop-ass across the table, but
that's another part of this holistic aspect, yeah?
It's such an extraordinary problem here, right? It's just, it's without being too pointed about it, it's such a distinct feature of our renewable supply chain here, of our renewable supply chain globally, because the points made earlier is that that supply chain goes everywhere. Now, it is the renewable supply chain. The majority of the manufacturing on that, all those sectors that happens on Earth happens there. So that's either an extraordinary build, because the point about the industrial advantage that doesn't go away is right. That's 25 years of investment, state-led investment, low cost of capital, long vision, capability to build an industrial base that you don't see in too many other places. You know, maybe Germany had a capability like that once. Maybe they could still have it. California has a capability like that, but much smaller scale, very focused. But that type of industrial systems development is not something that many people are good at and have shown. I mean, I should say South Korea, but smaller scale, right? There's a contention that we need to continue to engage with and face into on that, because I don't know that we're going to build the alternative industrial infrastructure soon. We are continuing to try to do it, including for the reasons of safety and other people wanting to gravitate away from that manufacturing base that we talked about earlier. But we're going to be facing into that for decades, that challenge. And we obviously here in a bunch of places, including in parts of Europe, have got our modern slavery directives and overlays. We're talking about a CBAM here. I think there's an interesting question. We saw the deforestation directive coming out of Europe, which has sort of been a bit on and a bit off and a bit adjusted, but nonetheless very powerful. And I think there's a very interesting question about some of those cross-border corporate procurement and consumption constraints that are starting to be utilized by Europe and will be utilized elsewhere, and whether those start to play a very delicate role in engaging with that supply chain, because I don't know that we're going to turn it off.
No. And I have one example from Europe or from a European company. I was 10 years part of the executive leadership of Telenor Group, which is a Norwegian majority state-owned company, but still listed. Part of the privatization of telecommunications, big in Asia, Eastern Europe, and the Nordics, used to be, a bit changed now. When I was there, we experienced in Asia, in our Asian supply chain, child labor, human rights violations, grotesque situations in Bangladesh, Pakistan, India. And it came, this is close to 15, 20 years ago. It came upon us with big surprise. At that time, we didn't have systematic supply chain ways of working, but we established it following this. And I believe every industry, although we have that today, we have that systematic way of working with supply chains, every industry, as you say, will have a period of time before we come up with alternatives or set limitations or the market starts working in compliant ways. It will happen here too. And that might open opportunities for other places in the world and the supply chain we see now. It will happen.
One more question, sorry, and then we're going to have to wrap. Hello.
Thank you. My name is Margot Black. I work for Investor Property Group. I have a question building a bit on what Robin was saying before about the just transition. Because APAC is such a diverse region, we don't have an EU one governing body. We are all individual nation states and we talk to each other about trade, but we don't talk to each other about transition. Everyone's on their own journey. I'd like to remind people the Pacifica is full of a lot of little islands that don't have big economies, have very little investment, and some of them are run off diesel. And so even though they are trying to get renewables, of course they don't run at night and they still have to run at night. So I think, you know, I pose a question to the panel to sort of say, what is the solution for that fair transition for the broader region that we can come together to support everyone from the big Indias and bigger populations to the teeny tiny ones to really have a joint approach versus an individual nationhood approach?
And some of those tiny nations are probably at the most risk of climate change.
That delegation that I was full of crying youth delegates in the train, the teary train, in my anecdote was a Pacific youth delegation that we used to be part of, which was we would turn up at COPs and they would have literally two negotiators and like a dog. And then you turn up to the US and they'd have like 170 people in a pavilion twice the size of this room. And it was all, that was the negotiating unevenness then. And a lot of that continues today. So very conscious of that setting. It's quite a lot of the conversation. I mean, the point you just made about the level of impact there is extraordinary. And the pathways we're on, the conversation there, of course, is twofold. And one piece of it is, how do you help transition a grid? How do you prioritize the transition of a grid or a microgrid? We have a couple of teams working on microgrids in regional Philippines. And I tell you what, it's a good thing it's a labor of love, because otherwise it would not happen. It's so difficult. But then there's also a question of what do you do and how do you support and how do you help communities that are so affected by climate risk that those communities probably won't be there at various points in the near future. I was super hopeful that we would get COP, because COP is this kind of extraordinary opportunity to try and do the bridge of the big Asian supply chains that are sort of cranking on climate and cranking on transition, and it's this opportunity in the future. And this jurisdiction that is Asia Pacific, which has got this also extraordinarily vulnerable set of counterparties in it, there's a knitting opportunity there, and people have talked about clean energy finance corporations for the region that might be centrally funded. That's a specific green bank that is doing development, transition and adaptation funding that would be centrally funded by larger entities, and all sorts of other interesting ideas that could be leveraged around COP. And I don't know if we're going to get COP, but I do think we're going to need to find the opportunities to do some of those things, because certainly I got sick of global climate negotiations 10 or 15 years ago because I just cannot deal. But the big holdup in those increasingly is our inability to navigate that transition footprint across those very different jurisdictions, not just in the Pacific.
And I'm not going to... Everything you say, I fully support, and you know more about this in this region. But I would just, in general, say that just transition is actually part of my reasoning. It's part of... You have to put people at the center. It needs to be affordable. It needs to be a development that is part of society's opportunities. And you need to do this because you come out at the other end where everything is more just than it was before. That's part of it. And that's policy making. That's sharing. And you have that across APAC today as well. Mm-hmm. So I believe APAC has a great opportunity, even if it's diverse. Maybe because it's diverse. Because you can drive policies in places where you will see the effect pretty soon. So just transition is at the center of the whole journey, in my thinking.
Mm. I'm going to add to that education. So one of the programs that I'm involved with, both as Australia and New Zealand governments, is we've rewritten the science curriculum for 5 Pacific Island nations and then helped establish all of that delivery with a local context. But what it's done, it's allowed 50% more year 10 students to study science at year 11. Those students are now able to have the grades to get into international universities to study STEM subjects. Those Pacific Island students are now, who's most passionate about fixing the Pacific? It's these students who now have the opportunity to have the knowledge and the engineering degree to come back home and drive that change. So when we talk about holistic, it's often about the people. If you can empower the people who care to want to make change, they can. We are out of time. We could have done this all day. But before we go, I have a very quick fire round that I would like to finish with. Louise, if you invited us back here, which I hope you do, in 5 years' time to this magnificent opera house, what single milestone would make you proud to say we have truly moved the dial?
And you look at me.
I think this is such a difficult question. I would have loved to see APAC in all its glory, having leapfrogged. Maybe I should say grid development in India.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
That would have been making other investments bankable.
Mm. I'd really like to see, starting to see, and would really like to see it prove out, a distinct Asian or approved in APAC but globally relevant adaptation model, because I'm on an adaptation kick at the moment where we're using hybrid or nature-based infrastructure and we've figured out a funding model for that infrastructure. Caitlin, I'm looking at you. We're going to have so much coffee to figure this out. But we are actually seeing that working across region with a set of demonstration projects underway, and we can say, we know something about how to fund that. We know something about how to do projects that you guys know technically how to do that make it all better and make it all easier and mean that you don't have to add potentially all of the air conditioners to the grid in all of the places. That's something I would really like to see us manage to pull off in the next 5 to 10 years. I'm sure we'll pull off lots of renewables manufacturing and other stuff like that as well, but that's the one I'm holding out for.
Perfect. Well, thank you, Hilda and Zoe, for your rich and thought-provoking insights. And to all of you for your questions, I'm sorry we didn't get to all of them. I know there were many, many more. I'd also like to offer an apology. I am a woman in engineering. I am quite vocal about diversity, and I would like to apologise for the lack of diversity at this event. I am sorry, but a hurricane has meant that we lost our only white man. And instead, we just had an event that was filled with the same smart, momentous, intelligent, driven, leading women. And so, with that, I would just like to invite one more of those women to the stage. Please join me in welcoming Kate West, Arup's Chief Officer for APAC Business and Markets, to share her reflections and close.
Thanks, Michelle. And no, it's not often we lack diversity in that sense, isn't it? So amazing night. I just have to say, I'm blown away. I mean, I come to a lot of these events. This is the best of the best. You know, we have these events. We have Momentus to provoke thought, to prompt discussion, to help each of us to think differently. And I have got that in spades tonight from the three of you. So I think, Louise, TC, I'm sorry, but I think your favourite podcast might be challenged by tonight. There might be a new favourite. So please join me with thanking Michelle, Hilda and Zoe for that incredible conversation. Thank you. But look, thank you fundamentally to all of you for joining us, both in the room and to those of you that joined online. As Michelle said, we've got over 600 people joining us online from across all of Asia Pacific as well as the world tonight to participate in this conversation. And I think we've heard some absolutely fascinating and really truly thought-provoking ideas from you. I was sort of scribbling notes as we went, and certainly I have learnt so much about how the Asia Pacific region can really take that leading role. We can leapfrog the globe, so to speak, in building resilience and building adaptation and addressing climate change. And there's no doubt for me in my role and working with TC and the team across Asia Pacific, we've got extraordinary challenges ahead of us. There's no doubt the more I sort of visit countries across Indonesia, the Pacific, throughout Asia as well as here in Australia, we have got challenges ahead, but there are also fundamental opportunities. And I think the more that we can learn, share, connect the dots, the faster we will go together. I just want to, I think, firstly say, Louise, to you and the Opera House, thank you so much to you and your team for hosting us here tonight. It's such a special partnership that we've got with you. You spoke about it at the start. It has gone for decades, but it's not just a partnership that lives in the past. I think it's a living and breathing partnership. My personal relationship with you I treasure, and I think between us we do great things. And I think tonight is just another such one of those events, and I look forward to continuing this into the future. To Dr. Michelle Dickinson for guiding our conversation tonight. Michelle, thank you. You are extraordinary at leading these types of conversations. I first met you on our podcast that we did many years ago about resilient cities, and I certainly think you're a strong friend of ARUP, and you certainly helped to bring our ideas to life in the podcast and in tonight's event. So huge thank you to you. And of course, a huge thank you to our two outstanding speakers and panellists, Zoe and Hilda. I mean, I got so much out. I've got some notes here. You know, Hilda, from you, great learnings globally and from the EU. Progress has been made on the energy transition, but APAC must be part of the solution. If APAC aren't part of the solution, there is no solution. And we have the opportunity to take these global learnings and leapfrog forward. But that will only happen with ambition, commitment, and pace. And as our new chair, I hear this from Hilda quite often. She is an absolute champion in terms of those attributes and commitment to pace. Zoe, so much from you. Louise actually leant over and whispered to me halfway through. She said, she's so smart. absolutely. Your analogy of energy transition as a slow hike up a tall, you know, and difficult hill at times absolutely resonated with me. But the need for economic and political will and bipartisan support, absolutely fundamental. We've got to stick to our guns and we have to invest. And I thought your joint message from both of you, Hilda and Zoe, that actually we have to build a world that's better after doing what we have done. You know, this is not just about us here and now, but it is about future generations, that commitment to complete sustainable development and actually shaping a better world absolutely resonated with me. I do want to express our gratitude to poor Mark, who's stuck back in America. You know, spent a lot of time trying to get here. So, Mark, if you have joined us online, so sorry you couldn't be with us, and we look forward to having you at one of these future events. We'll make sure you get here earlier next time. And a huge thank you, as I said at the start, to each one of you in the room. You know, only by your presence, your attendance, your buy-in do we get this sort of generosity of knowledge share that we have got tonight. This has truly been a great discussion.
What an incredible conversation with Hilda and Zoe, and what an honour to have hosted it at the Sydney Opera House. It was a great insight into how so many different industries and partnerships need to come together holistically to create lasting change. And what struck me the most was how the APAC region is no longer waiting for global direction, it's taking the lead, which gives me enormous hope for what comes next. If you enjoyed this episode, make sure to leave us a review and subscribe to Sustainable Forces on your favorite streaming platform, or watch us on YouTube. And stay tuned because season 4 is on the horizon. Keep an eye on Arup's channels for updates and new episodes coming soon.